Hey everybody, welcome to our webinar. Today hosted by the Colson Center, joined with our friends at the Alliance Defending Freedom, Waterstone, and the National Christian Foundation. I really appreciate you guys responding and wanting to hear what we're going to talk about today. I think it's absolutely critical. As you know, if you follow what we talk about on Breakpoint and other Colson Center content, we spend a lot of time talking about religious freedom, the ability to live out our faith in the public square. And a lot of times, the threats to that have come, obviously, from the state. There's an increasing amount of pressure being put on people of faith in the private sector, and especially when it comes to issues of taxation and issues of charitable giving. And so that's really what we wanted to jump into this morning in this webinar. And I'm joined by three folks who really live and breathe and drink and sleep this stuff. Jeremy Tedesco is the senior counsel for the Alliance Defending Freedom. He's also the vice president of U.S. advocacy for the Alliance Defending Freedom. We're going to launch out talking with Jeremy, who's going to give us the lay of the land. He's really been tasked by ADF to kind of keep his eye on this ball more than any other right now. And then we're going to be joined a little bit later from two folks who lead really what are two of the largest and oldest charitable giving platforms for Christians. Ken Harrison is the CEO of Waterstone. He is also the CEO of Promise Keepers, which, if you didn't know, Promise Keepers is getting a new relaunch in 2020. That's not what this webinar is about, but it's something you should know about. And then also Michael King is the vice president of gift planning services for the National Christian Foundation. And you often hear the National Christian Foundation in articles, when it comes to these sorts of topics, and we'll get to those kind of scare quote articles a little bit later. But Jeremy, I want to start with you. And before I do anything else, pay attention to Breakpoint this coming week. We're going to be talking about an enormous win that the Alliance Defending Freedom was a part of in Minnesota, having to do with a free speech case in the Eighth Circuit with some delightful people who are videographers named the Larsons. And before we even bring Jeremy on, I want to say congrats to Jeremy on behalf of ADF. But also, Jeremy was he argued that case before the Eighth Circuit and got a tremendous decision supporting conscience rights and free speech out of the Eighth Circuit just on Friday. So details are coming on Breakpoint. But Jeremy, I want to say congratulations to you, man. That was a huge win, and thanks for being a part of this conversation.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that. You know, the thing I'll say about the win in the Eighth Circuit is, you know, everybody talked about Masterpiece Cake Shop. Everybody knows that case and knows that the Supreme Court left open the free speech question in that case, only ruled on free exercise. And so that left people dissatisfied, rightly so, with the decision. And this decision we just got out of the Eighth Circuit really answers that question that was left open in a way that just emphatically endorses free speech and everything about our free speech principles in this country that makes our country great and makes us the emblem for free speech internationally. And it's just great to see a decision like that. We hope we can build off of it.
Well, I agree, but don't steal the thunder from my Breakpoint, man. It's good, and it's coming on Tuesday or Wednesday. So stop talking about that. That's not what we're here.
Yeah, I'm done.
I wanted to do one piece of housekeeping too before we get started. And Jeremy, what I want you to do is give us the lay of the land. But I want to say two things here first. First of all, this is being recorded, and so if you're taking notes, that's great. We are recording this, and we'll send that file with this recording to everyone who signed up for the webinar. Secondly, we want your questions. And so what we'd like to invite you to do is there is a chat function in Zoom, and you can submit your questions as we go and just send them as we go. Don't wait so that we can have some interaction on this. If you have a question that pops into your mind, put it in the chat box and send it. Heidi on our team is going to be kind of looking through those and collating those and sending those my way, so that I can interact with our panelists on those questions. Well, Jeremy, you've kind of been tasked by ADF to pay attention to the various, what we called it in the invite was financial levers, but the various ways that people of faith are being pressured and squeezed when it comes to really non-governmental entities. And a big part of that has to do with donor advised funds, which a lot of people use in their charitable giving. And so we've got about 10 to 15 minutes, Jeremy, could you kind of give us that lay of the land? What are Christians facing right now when it comes to these financial levers?
Yeah, thanks, John. Yeah, I like to call it progressive blacklisting. It's not a new phenomenon. In fact, we've seen it historically many times, this process of blacklisting people who are, disfavored or, somehow should be excluded or marginalized in society. But we see the progressive left really using this tactic today in ways that can have sweeping impact on the ability of Christian organizations to have an impact in the world, and even, donors and people who want to fund that work to be able to even provide funding for that work to continue. Progressive blacklisting is essentially, what it sounds like. It's when progressives put a list of groups and people together that they don't like. It's a list of their ideological enemies. They essentially spread misinformation about those people, and then they advocate that they be discriminated against, denied business and financial services, and censored. And this is really impacting Christian and conservative, and really religious conservative groups broadly, and more specifically Christian groups like Alliance Defending Freedom, where I work, and other Christian groups that have gotten themselves on these blacklists. The most prominent one that people will recognize is the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate list. They have a hate map of about 1,020 groups. It's a brilliant strategy. They lead with white nationalists and racists, people and groups that no one would dispute are absolutely hate groups. But then they have, now much more recently, but still it's not that recent, we're talking at least a decade old of this practice, they've started to add their ideological opponents to these lists as well. They've expanded the categories of hate to include their political enemies. And so it's not just racist, violence-inciting groups anymore. It's groups that don't have policies or positions they like on immigration, or policies and positions that they like when it comes to LGBT issues. And so the risk from the financial lever standpoint that we're talking about really comes in with the fact that these groups are proactively engaging in public advocacy campaigns and other pressure campaigns to try to force corporations to stop funding or harm in other ways the interests of groups like ADF, Colson Center, and others. And they're doing that in a couple of different ways. And John, I don't want to just talk for 15 minutes. So if you have specific questions, if you want me to pause and give you a chance to direct the conversation, I mean, I can continue. But what's your preference?
Yeah, well, I think that knowing those specific ways is really important. And, for example, Dan Lewis has already typed in a question, specifically asking about, is there a way that these lists, these blacklists, are being used? What are the specific ways that they're being used? He asked specifically about credit card processing, which is one of those services that we all rely on. How is that impacted, for example, and what are the other ways?
Yeah, let me run down the things that I think are the biggest concerns, and then I'll highlight the biggest. We've seen already real life consequences from these pressure campaigns that the left is mounting. They do them in a bunch of different industries. So financial is what we're here to talk about, but I also reference some things that are happening in the social media world and a couple other places. The first one, and the one that has bitten ADF already, is these progressive activists are asking tech companies to deny nonprofit pricing to religious organizations that are on their blacklists. And so at Microsoft, we no longer at ADF, and I know of many other ministries now, don't receive the very, very important financial benefit of nonprofit pricing when we get services or tech products from Microsoft. And that's true of some other tech companies as well. That greatly increases the cost of accessing essential tech services and support for ministries that pretty much everybody else benefits from. And remember, our ideological opponents on the other side of the issues that we advocate for every day, they have full access to all the nonprofit pricing they could dream of. And so this is a one-way ratchet that is just one of the various ways in which the left is trying to make it more difficult for their opponents to operate and be effective. And so, you know, to pull back for a minute and just say, understand that these tactics are all part of a much broader and orchestrated and well-funded strategy. I refer to it sometimes as a 360-degree problem for us, or another way to look at it is death by a thousand cuts. Losing your nonprofit pricing is awful, but it's not the end of the world. But if they do that, plus the five other things I'm going to describe, then you're really in trouble. So another thing right. that's happened is Amazon Smile. You know, the Amazon Smile probably doesn't give a ton of money to organizations like Colson Center, ADF, and others. It's not a robust giving program, but SPLC and its allies have convinced Amazon to use SPLC's hate list as a gatekeeper for access to the Amazon Smile program. So people are allowed to give over a million 501c3 charities through the Amazon Smile program. If you don't know what that is, it's just customers are allowed to give like 0.5% of what they purchase on Amazon's platform to the charity of their choice. There's a million charities at least. Oh, there's over a million that you can give to. Again, it's all the organizations that we work against or, you know, advocate against in the public square. And they all have access to Amazon Smile money. We don't because we're on the hate list. And there's many other religious charities like Family Research Council and others. That takes me to credit card processing. As far as the credit card processing world goes, the activists, again, have spun up very aggressive long-term advocacy campaigns to try to force credit card companies to stop processing donations to what the left deems to be hate groups. And so these pressure campaigns are designed to, and they're brilliant because, again, they lead with the white supremacists. If you look at their websites, they're all talking of, you know, there's pictures of swastikas and burning crosses. But on every one of those lists that they actually go to the company with is Alliance Defending Freedom and other religious charities that the left just doesn't like. And so that could immediately cut off access to millions of dollars in process donations a year. That's a significant cut and something that we have to work against. This campaign against credit card companies has also elevated to what I could deem the kind of the next level of advocacy from the left. Just last June, 2019, for the first time, progressives put on MasterCard's shareholder proxy statement. So it was a resolution for all their shareholders to vote on at their national shareholder meeting, asking MasterCard to set up what they called a human rights committee, who would be tasked with identifying hate groups and ensuring that they stop processing donations to those groups. This shareholder activism is an essential aspect of how the left gets what they want done in this world. They start the pressure campaign, then they take their ability to put resolutions on the company's shareholder proxy statements, and then build pressure campaigns around those resolutions, which gives them unprecedented access and leverage to negotiate for the outcomes they want when it comes to the way that in the kinds of policies that these companies have when it comes to these issues. Another enormous one that John mentioned is donor-advised funds. Fidelity, Vanguard, Schwab, and of course, many of our, some of the folks we have on this phone, NCF and others, and Waterstone, have these donor-advised funds set up. Great way for people to give to their passions. And the left has a campaign called Hate Is Not Charitable that's directed at the wide swath of the philanthropic world. Their goal is the
short term. Hey, Jeremy, real quick, say that again, because I want people to look this up. You can actually look this up. Hate Is Not Charitable. And that's actually pretty close to the name of the website as well, right?
Yes. It's by Amalgamated Foundation. Hate Is Not Charitable. You can go, and they have a whole campaign there. They have over 40 or 50 committed partners to the Hate Is Not Charitable campaign. And understand, the point of the Hate Is Not Charitable campaign is to mirror what they accomplished in Amazon. They want donor-advised funds to not just consider whether you're a 501c3 or not, to determine whether they're going to honor the donor's request that the funding go to the organization. They want an extra layer of review, and that extra layer is, are you on one of these progressive blacklists, the SPLC hate list or some other list? And if you are, then what they want is these organizations to stop, basically to say, we're not going to honor your request to send money to that organization. You're going to have to choose somebody else. And so the risk here is that you can no longer fund, if you have your money in some of these secular-based donor advised funds especially, you can no longer fund the charity of your choice because the left is going to take away your right to do that. And the other risk is, and I think this is a risk that's a little bit far out, but it's still on the horizon, is if they, I think the first layer for these secular-based donor advised funds, if they decide to do it, the first layer will be to say, we also won't honor funding requests for groups that are on the hate list. So you'll start getting denials for that. But then maybe, you know, some period of time later, they'll also say, we're not going to let you transfer your money from Fidelity to another donor advised fund if that other donor advised fund, like NCF or Waterstone, allows any donations to hate groups. And so your money will essentially be trapped in an institution that is won't allow you to fund directly the organizations you want to support and won't let you move your money to a foundation or donor advised fund group that will actually allow you to do that and honor your requests. So, hey, I mean, these
Jeremy,
terms are,
Jeremy, let me bring in, no, this is a, such a, an important one in my mind, because I'm just looking at the amount of resources that are provided for the Colson Center using donor advised funds. And we even looked through our list and saw, you know, okay, the gifts that have come in over the last couple of years through Fidelity or Schwab or some others. And I want to bring Michael King into this conversation quickly. Again, Michael is the VP of Gift Planning Services at NCF. And Michael, I think people might hear this and say, wait a minute, my money can be trapped in a fund against my will. It's my money. And can you explain how donor advised funds work and why, and is this, in your mind, Michael, this concern as legitimate as Jeremy's making it out to be? Michael, are you there? Yeah, I wonder if we lost him. Heidi, maybe you can shoot Michael quick.
I'm sorry, John, I'm here. I was
there
on
you
mute.
Go. I do that all the time. Okay, unmuted now. Okay, did you understand the question?
Yeah, absolutely. So, so let me tell you a little bit how a donor advised fund works. Technically and legally, when a contribution is made into a donor advised fund, that asset now becomes the legal ownership of the donor advised fund sponsor, whether that's Waterstone, NCF, Fidelity, whoever. So it's an important thing to understand, and there's obviously a trust component to that. And then the families that contribute those assets, they continue to have advisory rights. That's the legal terminology. So they can tell the sponsor or request from the sponsor, hey, we'd like to make contributions to this organization in whatever amount and at this time. But legally, the donor advised fund sponsor can reject or decline those requests. So it's very important to understand how that works, and exactly what you guys are talking about. We're seeing increasing activity in this context, not only in the donor advised fund world, but also in the private foundation world. We have an attorney general in California that is auditing, and I would say really harassing a private foundation, largely simply because it's giving to faith-based organizations, even though its purpose and charter doesn't specifically reference those types of organizations. And we also see this in various community foundations throughout the country, where they have increasing restrictions on granting out to churches or other faith-based organizations.
So it's even beyond just this particular financial product. To just foundations themselves. And I think that's what Jeremy was talking about with that kind of coalition of groups that have kind of committed not to give to the hate list. And Jeremy, there's been a ton of questions come in. One is just kind of one that I think many of us have, which is, why is the Southern Poverty Law Center hate group list so powerful? Like, what happened between then and now to make that the standard? And it's been a largely discredited group in many ways. And I think one of the questions too is there a way to push back on this? I mean, can we come up with our own list, and what would that look like? and what are the reactions to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, how many hours do we have, John? I mean, no.
Yeah, well, not very many. You got to keep it quick. I got to bring Ken in here in a second, too.
Yeah. I'll be quick. You know, I think the Southern Poverty Law Center's influence is explained by the fact that they did a great job for years doing work that was incredibly popular. They built this unbelievable reputation. It's just a stalwart in the civil rights community. And they were doing work that everybody agreed with. The Klan shouldn't be able to have influence in our society. These are bad groups that somebody should monitor. And what they've done, though, of course, is twist that fear that people have of real violence-inciting racist groups and turn it against their political enemies. And so they've been called out on that for a long time. I mean, we're talking at least over a decade. But it just hasn't had the kind of, impact on their credibility and their reliability that we would hope. However, they've had some pretty significant self-inflicted credibility wounds recently with their employees essentially having, some kind of an insurrection, calling out for the firing of their founder and their long-term president, both of which happened back in March. And reports coming out from many mainstream papers, CNN and news sources and others, saying that there's a systemic culture of racism and sexism within SPLC. So the very organization that says, they are the arbiter of these things in society doesn't even have their own house in order. And so they've got some serious credibility problems, but, it's a long-term fight with them. I think, from the standpoint of what we can do, there's so much, even just little things like donors on this call, calling up Fidelity and Schwab and Vanguard and saying, I've been made aware of these pressure campaigns to get you to stop funding organizations that I care about. And I want you to know, I want an answer on whether you're actually going to do something like that and cave to these demands. If the answer is yes, I'm out. I'm gone. And just mounting our own pressure campaigns on them. But I think I'm convinced that another thing we have to do is collectively, with a broad tent mentality, and the conservative and religious side of these issues, engage the left, in the corporate boardrooms, in the shareholder activism realm. Because I went to the Amazon shareholder meeting in May to do a little combat on the fact that we're still on the SPLC hate list and therefore can't get funding through Amazon Smile. And there were 12 shareholder resolutions that were being discussed during that meeting. 10 of them were the most far-left resolutions that you could probably conceive of. One of them was from the right. The gentleman who stood up to present the one from the right got jeered at, sneered at, chuckled at, and booed. All the left ones were, it was like a standing ovation each time. And so in many ways, the conservative and religious community have abandoned trying to influence corporations to just be neutral on these issues, to respect the broad scope of their customers' beliefs and views. And I think if we engage on that and in that way, we can do a lot of really good work quickly to pull people back from the brink in the corporate world.
Ken, I want to bring you into this conversation because you and I, we've been friends for a while, and I remember you and I having this conversation a couple of years ago, and then over the last year in conversations with ADF and just things we were seeing, it was kind of like, saying, oh, this is serious. And we've got tons of questions coming in, and I want you to take the first stab at a group of three by Mark who typed in these. But before that, would you just speak a little bit to, in fact, Jeremy just said, if these guys would just be neutral, if they just wouldn't take a side. But increasingly, what we're seeing is corporations are taking a side. Like, it's the new thing. We call it woke capitalism. What do you think in terms of, you've been in the business space. Now you're in this space with Waterstone. Why is it important that we line up with organizations that share our beliefs?
Well, so you've thrown me the worldview question, and you're the worldview guru. It's a long, long history of the fact that wicked leaders unify people around a common enemy. Great leaders unify people around a common cause, right? And we see this happening now, and that enemy is more and more becoming Christians. And Christians continue to run down after politics to solve problems when it's really the corporations that are becoming the problem, the amount of money that's being poured into really bad causes. And the reason that occurs is quite simple. Christians don't stick together. The people who are so abject in their worldview and their hatred of Christianity, as 2 Corinthians says, we're the smell of life to those given to life and the stench of death to those given to death. They hate our message when they don't want to receive Jesus Christ. So we see that they are very unified, and corporations are terrified of making the left angry, but they don't need to worry about making the right angry because we don't stick together. So we need to, in every way we can, start to support each other, support Christian businesses, and just to start avoiding businesses who hate what we do. I mean, the Starbucks CEO famously said, if you don't support gay marriage, we don't want your business. And Christians went, that's cool. Let's all go to Bible study at Starbucks. There's been zero effect to Starbucks for making such an agreement. Statement. That goes to show how big this problem is. And so we need to stick together for these donor advised funds. And I'm not suggesting that anybody needs to run off and turn their money over to Waterstone or to NCF. But we do definitely need to be heard.
Well, that's really Mark's question. And basically, you know, kind of looking at that going, look, if they pulled the trigger on this and said, okay, we're going to adopt the SPLC hate list, he'd move his assets. But is there a warning shot? And that's kind of, and this is somewhat of a subjective question. They have a lot, these companies have a lot to lose, you know, but so did the credit card processor have a lot to lose for pulling the trigger on ADF. They make a lot of transactions. Can we legitimately send a warning shot to organizations like Schwab, like Fidelity, and what would that actually look like? But is it actually possible? And, you know, does that make sense, Ken? What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Because that is happening and it is coming to a channel near you. I guarantee that we've already been contacted by newspapers, major newspapers, saying, why did you give money to the Family Research Council in very threatening tones? If you don't get on board, we're going to punish you. Now, they haven't done that yet, which tells me they don't think they're strong enough yet to go after foundations, or they would have. They've made it very clear to us, tried to intimidate us from giving to Christian organizations. Of course, that's why we exist, so it's never going to work. But they're coming. They're just waiting to get strong enough. We've got to stick together as Christians. If somebody does something that makes the left angry, they're going to have a mob outside their store. If someone does something to make the right angry, it's a yawner. And we've got to start sticking together as Christians. And one of the biggest ways is, where are we putting our money?
Yeah. Jeremy, Brad asked a question. Before that, I wanted to get to Penny's question. She said, who can obtain the hate list from the SPLC? That list is made public, Penny. I'm sure you can get it on the website or through a quick Google search, Jeremy, if you know a specific place. I've seen it in various places played out, but it's not a private list. It's very much a list that they use kind of on a level of public leverage. Brad's asking if there is, and this is an appropriate question for you, given the case, the Larson case, which we talked about at the very beginning, which was a pre-enforcement challenge. Is there a pre-enforcement challenge in the future here, or for something like this, or when you're talking about private organizations and private, you know, he's asking about, you know, public accommodation laws with credit card donations. There's been some harm done there with our friends at the Ruth Institute and others. What do you think about that?
We're all options are on the table. We're exploring some creative legal theories to try to hold these companies accountable to, you know, both, yes, public accommodations laws, but there are also some financial industry regulations and statutes and things that bar discrimination in the lending and banking industry that aren't just, you know, these broad-based public accommodation laws, but really focus in on the banking and financial industries. And make no mistake, that's what's going on here. I mean, this is religious discrimination. If you hold a certain set of religious views, the goal of the left is to put you outside of acceptable society and to ostracize you. And they do that in lots of different ways. It's not just, like I said before, the financial and banking and donor advised fund things that we're talking about here, but there are ongoing campaigns to get us deplatformed, or at least to get our content suppressed and demonetized on social media platforms. And, you know, there's just this kind of endless 360 degree thing. I often describe it like every time I I get up in the morning, I'm looking at another, you know, attack or threat against us that's all inspired ultimately by the SPLC and some of these other progressive activists who are trying to silence their opponents. And so, we're looking at legal options. I'm convinced that we're going to have some, but the bigger thing I think that needs to happen is the public relations and advocacy component of it that the last panelist was talking about, where we really need to come together and unify around these issues to try to protect our interests and protect the kind of society we want to live in. Because make no mistake, this is contrary to a free society. I mean, this is essentially trying to achieve through the corporate boardroom what the left can't achieve through the law. And think about it this way: we win these cases at the Supreme Court, at the Eighth Circuit. But if the left figures out how to make corporate America punish us for those wins, defund us for those wins, censor us for those wins, then those wins are going to have far less impact than if they're respected in our culture. And that's where we need to get back to.
Well, that's a huge point. We said this on Breakpoint a number of times, that if you kind of look at the spectrum of culture, the sphere of education, the sphere of business, the sphere of arts, education, when it comes to a lot of the more recent challenges that we face that kind of feel like a tsunami, particularly when it comes to the LGBT issue, for example, it was really when that business segment kicked over that a whole new level of pressure came. And on ideas of religious freedom, on conscience, on free speech. And so there's a lever that the business world has that these other things don't. We're getting just incredible questions here, and I want to get to as many of them as possible. Christine and Kenneth both asked if there's some sort of list or a clearinghouse for businesses that are openly hostile, that don't just play it even, but are openly hostile. There is. In fact, it's a growing group, and they're an impressive group. It's called Second Vote. I think their web, you could probably just find them by Googling them at Second Vote. Basically, they're trying to keep track of this. I'm not usually a guy that says, let's go boycott everything, but there is a question of where do I want, my money to go? And that's a really good, question. Michael, let me bring you back into this, because there's a bunch of, kind of a handful of questions here by Dean. And, he says this, please, and I want you to just respond to this. Please be as clear as possible to listeners the fact that firms and foundations which receive and manage donor advised funds have full control over the funds, and that the role of the donors moves to advisors. That's a really clear way of saying what I think we've been trying to say. Michael, would you agree? Is that an accurate way to put it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, the whole purpose of this this webinar is touching on that. The fact that we're seeing more and more hostility, more and more intentionality in kind of using some of these tools or even weapons in ways that prevent people from doing and accomplishing what they're really trying to do. That's exactly correct. And it's part of the reason why I think the trust factor is so important. And, personally, I think Ken at Waterstone would say the same thing. We interact with Fidelity, Schwab, Vanguard. We have very cordial relationships with them. In many respects, we embrace the fact that a rising tide floats all boats. People need to at least be aware that those things can change, and they can change without warning. And so there is a possibility that, one or more of these organizations eventually says, hey, we're going to embrace these restrictions and may not give people an opportunity to transfer those assets prior to that time. So we have people on a regular basis that come to us specifically because they were working with, for example, a community foundation that denied a grant to a faith-based organization or their church, and that's the whole reason they went looking for somebody else to work with.
Yeah. Mark says it would be nice to have email links where we could send kind of quote-unquote canned notices to these companies if the intentions are known. I think that's a great idea. Jeremy, maybe that's something you and I should kick around after the call about whether we could take that on. Carol asks, what other nonprofits other than ADF and FRC are being heavily targeted by progressives? Again, we're talking mainly about the weaponized blacklist, and the SPLC list is the most popular and the most powerful. I'm honestly quite grumpy that we haven't yet made the SPLC hate list. It's kind of on my, you know, goals. And as soon as it, trust me, as soon as we make that list, I'm going to put it on breakpoint so that everyone can know. It's really anybody that's on that list. And I do think there was a question earlier, Jeremy, and I want to come back to it because you had your list of four or five ways that that we're seeing this right now. You know, the loss of nonprofit pricing, Amazon Smile, credit card processing, and then donor advised funds. And I missed the question here. Let's see. I'm looking back through the list. Suzanne asks, I often give through my work. And a lot of workplaces have that ability to give as well. That seems to be another potential area where another one of the thousand cuts. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, I just didn't get to it, but it's on my list. It's actually the last one. And it's corporate matching.
But somebody cut you off. Who was that jerk that cut you off and didn't let you get to that point?
No, it's a great question. And certainly we have seen ourselves, some employees have emailed us and said, I'm a longtime donor to ADF. And for the first time this year, corporation so-and-so said they would not match my gift to ADF because you're on some list of groups they no longer give to. I mean, these are all the insidious little back channel ways that the left convinces corporate America to make it more difficult for their ideological opponents to do the work they do and advocate for the things they advocate for. Corporate matching gifts is another huge problem, but I wanted to kind of address this idea of, and I try to say this every time, and it relates kind of to a question you asked, John, so I'm just going to take liberty here and say it. The SPLC is just one iteration of the broader phenomenon of progressive blacklisting. You know, what other nonprofits, the question was, have been targeted? Well, the NRA is currently being targeted by the state of New York, many major corporations, many federal officials, and they want to put them out of business. Also the life community. You know, you saw Pinterest ban and deplatform Live Action from its platform. And that's just a leading edge of the way in which, you know, the left will say, well, all these life groups are bad. They're bad actors. To take the left's talking points, they all spread misinformation about abortion. They're all lying to women. You know, all the things that people say about on the left about the life groups that we all love and support. Well, those are now reasons, and those are the reasons Pinterest gave for deplatforming Live Action. Well, those same, you know, all the life groups are going to be on the same blacklist, probably already are, for these kinds of similar actions. The thing is, it's not just the hate group list. One of the ones I think your listeners should be very much aware of is Church Clarity. Go to the website, Church Clarity. Church Clarity is a clearinghouse for churches put out by progressive activists where they are assessing a church's statements of belief and different policies that they make publicly available and determining whether they have policies that the left doesn't like. And the one they don't like the most, they call clear, when you have policies that are clear, non-affirming. And this is what they say. You get that if your church welcomes LGBT people, but will not ordain, hire, or marry LGBT people. Well, that describes pretty much every church that faithfully follows the Bible's teachings about marriage and sexual morality and the nature of humanity. And so, you know, the left already has a blacklist for churches. It's every church that follows orthodox biblical teaching about these issues. And we're starting to already see how this clearinghouse at Church Clarity is being used to deny, you know, invitations to major conferences and all this different kind of stuff. I mean, these things are not on the horizon. They're on the doorstep. And they really impact the entire religious community and the conservative world as well. So to go back to the last panelist, or one of the panelists' point, you know, we need to just put aside our differences and our niche interests and work together collaboratively, try to stop these things from continuing to happen.
Yeah. Ken, I want to bring you back into this conversation. Just let me hit a couple issues quickly. Jay, who asked for the name again of the website that has companies, this is called Second Vote, vote, like vote with your vote, and then vote with your money is the idea there, second vote. And then the question also came in about whether we are recording this from someone who joined late. Yes, we are recording this, and you will get a full recording that you can listen to again and share. Ken, there was a great question here about, because you really were definitive on we need Christians to stick together. And the question was, well, what's that look like? What's the first couple steps for that? What do you think, Ken?
Well, we need information for people. I was thinking about that as I was reading some of these questions. And I read, and Jeremy, I don't know if you know this is true. I don't want to give wrong information, but I had read that Ford Motor Company recently announced that they will no longer match employee donations to Planned Parenthood. That's a big deal. So if you give through your company, as somebody had asked, your company will match that donation. Ford said, we will not ever give to Planned Parenthood, nor will we. And Jeremy, I see you on there. Do you have an answer to that? Is that right?
I have heard that as well. And I can't, I just don't have independent confirmation right now. I'll see if I can find it.
And I had done some checking, and I'm fairly sure that's accurate. And so for me, I thought, well, I need a new car. I'm going to buy a Ford. I'm going to buy a new truck. It's going to be a Ford this time. But how many people know that? And as you had mentioned, Stone Street, I run Promise Keepers as well. We went to make some Promise Keepers fleeces. We went to Patagonia and to get the fleeces, and they were delighted, of course, that we were going to do this until they found out that we were Promise Keepers, and then they refused. So we went to Kuhl, K-U-H-L, who made all of our fleeces for us. People need to know that. And when Promise Keepers is back and has some clout, everyone in the world is going to know that Patagonia refused to make our fleeces and that Kuhl did make our fleeces. Again, but where as a Christian do you get this information? We need, and I'd love to see you guys take the lead on this, to know, again, we're not boycotting, but let's with our money support people who are doing godly things, and let's not support people who are doing wicked things.
Yeah, I want to follow that up, because there was another question that I thought was really important. And this kind of falls into a category of what we call around the Colson Center, we've got to learn to walk and chew gum at the same time. And you've described the walking, and here's what I mean about the chewing gum. If you followed Breakpoint, we reported over the last couple of years on the increasing pressure from the state of California on educational institutions. And by the way, that question came up as well. I mean, we're seeing pressure on educational institutions. We're not even talking about charitable giving. We're just talking about LGBT policies being forced in order to access state funds and scholarship dollars for students and so on. And the state legislator that was pushing that through was very, very aggressive on this. And suddenly, it looked like suddenly decided to pull back on the legislation. Well, it wasn't suddenly. As the story came out, very similar, by the way, to the initial gay activist that wrote about the Kathy family, the Chick-fil-A family, that they got to know each other and they became friends. What happened in the case of the California legislator is that two of the college presidents of large Christian colleges in California invited him on campus, toured him around. And not only were they able to say, look, they're actually providing a really good education here, but they're providing a really good education to an awful lot of ethnic minorities in particular. And if the Cal Grant was pulled out of the equation for these students, they couldn't get the education. So by kind of advancing one proposed minority group, they're actually going to harm an actual minority group. And then that changed things. But that can only happen through that kind of personal relationship. And I think that's, Jeremy, what you were saying in terms of just showing up at the boardroom, we miss a lot of those opportunities. And how do we actually reach out to, we think of, Patagonia as a corporation, and they are a corporation, but they're a corporation made of leaders. And, I think as there is opportunity to reach across the aisle to these folks, to talk to them at some level, I think we need to learn how to, learn how to do that. We're headed kind of down the home stretch here, and there's so many great questions that continue to come in, and I'll try to get to as many of them as possible. But Ken, I want to punt it back to you and then go give Michael a chance, because as we talk specifically about the pressure on donor advised funds, maybe a little uncomfortable to just give a commercial here, but talk about kind of what Waterstone offers in terms of that service. I want to give people, if this sort of thing has alarmed them and they want to go ahead and move their money. I want to give them a chance to kind of know what options are out there.
Yeah, sure. And NCF and us are dear friends. Their CEO and I are really close, and we refer to each other, and we are not competitors in any way, shape, or form. We are competitors with Schwab and Fidelity, but we work together. We just want to fund the kingdom. And this stuff is real. I went to a friend of mine who runs a major oil and gas fund. He's got money with the Denver Foundation and said you should move the money from their foundation over to us. And on their homepage is a giant picture of the Boulder Women's Clinic that they love to give to, which is to slaughter babies. And he just couldn't be bothered to get around to it until he found out that they decided to defund Boy Scouts. So they had literally, if you were at the Denver Foundation, you could not give your money to the Boy Scouts. So I wanted to say this is real. Another reason why you really want to consider going with a Christian donor advised fund is that we actually had surplus funds last year at Waterstone. So we knew of a woman who had 20 sex slave girls in Kenya sleeping in her 640 square foot house. So with those surplus funds, we built a school, a dorm, a well, a new house, and now there's 150 sex slave girls who are there getting a Christian education because Waterstone took the money that we made from doing what we do, the surplus money, and gave it. I guarantee you Schwab and Fidelity and whatnot are not doing that. And so from the donor advised funds, we also do charitable trusts and act as trustees for people. But we can tell you we are here for one reason. It's not to make money. It's to give as much money away. And lastly, I'll say, when I came into Waterstone 2.5 years ago, identity means a lot. And the words you use to describe yourself say a lot about you. And one of the things I said to our Waterstone staff is, when people say how big is Waterstone or who are you, we talk about not how much money we manage for people, but how much we give away. And so we're able to give $1 million a week away, mostly through donor advised funds that people direct where they want that to go. And since I've been at Waterstone, we've denied 2 grants. One was to the Southern Poverty Law Institute. Someone thought that they were a great Christian organization, and when we educated them, they were very happy that we did. And the other was to a really awful church that I had previously debated that pastor on LGBTQ stuff and whatnot. And that church was one of those Laodicean churches that wasn't scriptural. And that person also was very grateful. So that's my quick commercial.
Yeah, and give us your website, Ken, just so everybody can follow you. And the question came, are we going to provide links to all these organizations? And the answer is yes. We'll send that in the follow-up email along with the recording. But Ken, go ahead and give everybody Waterstone's web address.
Waterstone.org.
Waterstone.org, real simple. Good. Mike, let's bring you back in here. Michael King from NCF, and I'll give you a chance to kind of answer the same question for Ken. What is it that NCF offers that folks might be interested in?
Yeah, well, first, just to piggyback off of Ken's comment about the focus of most of these Christian donor advised fund platforms is our primary emphasis is getting resources out to the kingdom and other organizations that are doing great work. So if you look at industry statistics on percentages of grants going out, both in relation to assets as well as annual contributions, the Christian organizations are at the highest echelons. There's usually a very significant gap between any of the other donor advised fund sponsors. And sometimes that's challenging in terms of our business model, because a lot of these organizations, their business model is built on collecting and effectively storehousing contributions and assets. It allows them to grow, but that's not necessarily what they're about. In terms of, I think both Water Street and NCF, our primary engine is a donor advised fund platform, but we do a lot of things beyond just donor advised funds. We really have a comprehensive suite of tools and resources and counsel around charitable giving, and even beyond charitable giving in terms of how it integrates with the family's other financial and wealth objectives. One area in particular that the Christian donor advised fund organizations have been kind of pioneers in is helping families give from assets beyond just cash and marketable securities. So both of our organizations facilitate a tremendous amount of gifts of real estate, private business interests, intellectual property. And if you look at the giving statistics, probably about 80% or more of all giving that's done in our country is simply done in the form of cash. And yet, if you look at the wealth composition of families cumulatively or collectively, cash represents less than 10% of what people own. So we've recognized all of this wealth that's in assets outside of cash, and we've been working hard over the last few decades to help families release that for kingdom purposes. And then a whole slew of other things. We counsel families on the broad array of charitable vehicles. We'll counsel on private foundations, donor advised funds, supporting organizations. More and more families are using more than one of those vehicles in order to capture the greatest overall benefits and mitigate negative aspects about some of these vehicles. We do a lot of zero estate tax planning, income tax planning, capital gain planning. So there's a real suite of resources that are available through these organizations.
I want to ask, bring Christine's question to both Michael, you and Ken, because I think it'll help us kind of get to one other issue that I wanted to get to here in the few minutes we have left. She asks, what's the benefit of using a donor advised fund as opposed to just giving individual donation to chosen entities? And part of the answer to that question has to do with the new 2017 Tax Act, which according to the American Enterprise Institute, this year for the first time, we saw a negative impact on charitable giving, which people predicted because of a larger standard deduction. And so the benefit of using a donor advised fund, in light of that, many people actually see there's more benefit now. Ken, you want to take first stab at that?
Sure, there's a lot to that. So for different ways, if you have a large event in 1 year, you can give all of that money in that 1 year and get the deduction when you need. So I, as you know, John, I sold my company in 2006, got a massive payday. I didn't know anything about donor advised funds. It was November. So I ran around just giving money away to organizations. I was their best friend for a year. I was barraged with letters for like a year. And after that, they realized that was a one-time deal. If I had had a donor advised fund, I could have put all that money into the donor advised fund, gotten the tax break when I needed it, and it was sitting there to give away when I wanted to. Another really good thing about it is you can give confidentially, which I like as well. So I use a donor advised fund because I give to churches and organizations, and I don't necessarily want them to know that it came from me. And also, I was sitting with a guy who has a massive amount of his business goes through Whole Foods, and he was very conservative politically. I said, you know, I want to give to pro-life groups and whatnot, but if Whole Foods ever found out that I did and they cut off my business, they would destroy my company and several hundred employees. Well, through a donor advised fund, if you go through NCF or Waterstone, no one can trace that back to you. So if you give to something that's very, very conservative or controversial, and you're worried, well, someday I may want to run for politics or this or that. If you give through Waterstone or NCF, no one can trace that back to you. And Michael, I'll punt the $24,000 question back over to you so you have something to answer.
Okay, sure. Yeah, that was a great list, Ken. So in terms of the 2017 Tax Act and the increased challenges with the higher standard deduction, and less folks giving or itemizing their deductions, there's at least three strategies that are beginning to be implemented to help families that may have previously itemized but either will no longer do so or at least not do so on an annual basis. So let me just run quickly through those three strategies. One is referred to as bunching, which is basically saying, I'm going to make larger charitable gifts every few years, and then in between those years, I'm going to take the standard deduction. And by doing that, by bunching my charitable contributions into every couple of years, I can capture the tax benefits of that. So I think we're going to see an increasing number of folks that implement that strategy. Another opportunity is to give appreciated assets. In particular, the classic example is appreciated marketable securities. So even for a family that may not be capturing a charitable deduction benefit, they can still capture a tax benefit by giving appreciated stock to charity. The charity sells that stock, and then neither of them pay any tax on the gain. So at least you're capturing, that's always been a great strategy. For some families, they can capture double tax benefits, but even for families that no longer itemize, they can still capture that one tax benefit. And then the third strategy, and ultimately assuming that the current tax law basically stays in effect, it's many of the provisions are set to sunset in 2026. But assuming that those laws stay in there, I think at some point we may see the single largest source of charitable giving coming from IRA accounts. So you can make what are called charitable qualified charitable distributions from an IRA. And by doing that, the individual making that grant or that gift or transfer doesn't have to recognize that income on their tax return. So they don't get a charitable deduction for it, but if they're not itemizing, they wouldn't have gotten one anyway. So because so much of the wealth in our country, particularly for middle-class families, is held in their houses and retirement accounts, I suspect that over time, this may be the single largest source from which folks will first look to do their giving.
Yeah, and it seems to me like the new tax plan makes it more compelling for people who wouldn't typically be major donors. You know, if we're talking about those giving millions and millions away, the donor advised funds now with this new tax act maybe is a compelling option for those who give generously, but maybe don't quite reach up to the means of others. Would that be accurate, do you think, Michael?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for higher income, higher wealth families, the new tax act really doesn't have a whole lot of negative implications. In fact, there are certain components of it that have enhanced benefits to it. So, yeah, I think this is really going to be most applicable to middle and lower middle class families.
All right, Jeremy, I'm going to give you the last word here on a couple of issues. First, let me hit a couple questions. One is are there other ways in which this sort of pressure is being applied on college campuses and university campuses? Carol, that's a whole completely separate webinar that would take more than an hour. The short answer is yes, and it's beyond the scope of this particular webinar. But there are a lot of pressure on university campuses. And ADF, by the way, if you know of a student who's facing that, there are some rights that students have. You can follow the state of North Carolina. They've been really aggressive in dealing with bias on university campuses, and ADF has a Division for Academic Freedom, which will represent students that are caught in that situation. Let's see, that was the one I wanted to get to. And then there was also the question of, Nathan, thanks for pointing out that Zoom's CEO has been pro-abortion. That's something we did not know. And it underscores the struggle of woke capitalism, which is keeping your list up to date. Oh, that's not awkward at all. I can always count on Nathan to do that to us. It's hard. It's hard to keep up. And one of the questions was, Christine, why are panelists not supportive of boycotting businesses? I think what you heard from us is some of us are, and some of us are in certain situations. It's not kind of the first option all the time. And one of the things is, and this is Jeremy, where I want to come back to you. One of the things I wanted to bring up is that when we do exit from, you know, either as a shareholder or something like that, we lose our leverage. We've seen that, for example, when board members at university or for universities and colleges, out of protest because of, you know, behavior of the administration or beliefs that change among the faculty, resign in protest. Well, that makes a really loud statement, and then they now no longer have any influence, and the board spots are built up by those who are hostile to Christian beliefs or whatever. And that's the challenge of, by boycotting, you can put the financial pressure on that Ken described. That's what Second Vote is all about. That's why we're recommending that. I think it is an appropriate response many times. But there's also that walk and chew gum thing where we want to keep the pressure on. And Jeremy, I know you, you know, represent ADF, which has, you know, done things like pre-enforcement challenges and encourage people. We've said on Breakpoint, we'll know when it's time for us to leave the public square, because we'll have a big foot in our rear end pushing us out. But we should stay as long as we can. And I want you to speak to that just a little bit, because there is that temptation. We need to be wise with our money. We need to line up. We need to support each other. And there's also that need for courage, like the Larsons and Jack Phillips and so on exhibited as well.
Yeah, in the corporate context, I think the problem is if we abandon every corporation or boycott every corporation that's antagonistic to our values, will probably be able to drink Coke and drive Fords. And maybe, because I'm not sure what their record is on other issues. So, you know, my general, you know, view on this is boycotting is a fine strategy, but I want to do everything I can before I boycott to make a positive difference in corporate culture and the way they engage on these issues. There's definitely a problem with leftists running a lot of these corporations, but they also have pretty much a one-way channel of communication coming from the left, asking them to do this, this, and this. If there was a counterbalance, a counterweight coming from our side, they would be far less inclined to alienate a whole, you know, swath of their customer base if they thought they were mobilized, active, and had a voice as well. And so my mentality is, as John said, if we abandon too quickly, we lose our ability to have leverage, to have influence. And, you know, this is me talking more than, you know, ADF, but I think there's plenty of people at ADF that think this way. John, I know, does too. I'd rather fight on every hill and lose if I'm going to lose or win if I'm going to win than just abandon the field. You know, we're called to, you know, be salt and light in every corner of our culture. And, you know, I think that also includes, you know, the corporations and all these other folks that are seemingly increasingly antagonistic to us. And there might be a point where the boot is applied and we're pushed out, and that's fine. But I want to be able to say when that happens, if it happens, that I did everything I possibly could to avoid that eventuality, and didn't just accept it and walk away without putting up a fight.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think that's a great way to end. I want to again commend to you all three of these organizations. These are our brothers and sisters in Christ who are in the middle of these challenges. A lot of you mentioned in the comments, you know, I knew it was there, but I didn't really know it was this intense or that bad. And so the good news is ADF has been there for decades now, defending people's rights to live out their faith in the public square. The private sector challenges are completely different. And so we need to walk with wisdom and be circumspect. And look, without Waterstone and NCF mobilizing resources for the kingdom of God, it would be a very, very different scenario when it comes to anything from you know, the ability of ADF to do what they do, the fight against global human trafficking worldwide, the ability for the Colson Center to put out our content, and so many different organizations. We're so grateful to have the partnership that we do with the National Christian Foundation and Waterstone, and they have been an essential service provider for so many people of faith, and also the benefit that comes through us as we work together for the kingdom of God is stunning. Now, just a couple housekeeping things here as we close. I know we're just about 3 minutes longer than we said we would be. Let me say this. First, we're going to ask each of our panelists to put together any list of resources that they would like to communicate to you, and that would include also how to get in touch with their organizations, and we will put that together with the link to the recording of this webinar and send it off to everyone who signed up for the webinar. And I know a lot of folks sign up and aren't able to listen to it live. And so being able to get the recording is one of the big benefits of doing it this way. You are more than welcome to share this widely with friends and family. Please don't post on social media. But if you would want to send it to friends and family who are in the same sort of, you know, have the same sort of questions that you do, please stay tuned for that. A lot of you are saying thanks. Thank you for being a part of this. Thank you for caring. Thank you for spreading the word. We'll continue to offer these webinars on different topics throughout the year, just because we know that it's hard to keep up with everything, like we ourselves found out even today. Thanks to Nathan. Nathan, it's good to have you on the webinar, brother. And listen, we're grateful for all of you, Jeremy, Michael, and Ken. Thanks for bringing the wisdom to this, and we're grateful for you as well. And if that's all, we will close with that. Thanks everybody for being a part of this.